Okay, do we have any questions on the Book of Numbers?
I have a general question and a specific question. In chapter 14, verse 38, they mention that Caleb and Joshua were the only spies that were going to see the land of Canaan. And in chapter 13, when they list all the spies, one from every tribe, they mention Caleb. I'm sorry. They don't mention Joshua as being a spy. In chapter 13, I think I'm going off the top of my head, I think it's 13.
Yeah, it is 13. Well, yes, he is mentioned. In Numbers 13:8, it's an alternate form of his name.
Okay.
So in a sense, it would be like if you had a formal name and it was William, and then the person went by Bill, this is that type of a situation. And so, he's the son of Nun, it's the same person.
So my more general question was, what is there theologically that we should take away from Numbers? There's a lot of good history.
Well, one of the things that we see quite a bit of in this section is failure on Israel's part, because we have rebellion against the leadership that God has put in place. And we also have disobedience on the part of Moses. One of the things that, and then you get into Balaam, and you're looking at disobedience, he had to be corrected by his donkey. I mean,
that's hilarious. Can you go over this? Wait, he was reading that on our way in.
Balaam was definitely toying with receiving a diviner's honorarium, and Lord told him, no, don't go.
Was he an Israeli? Seemed like he was a foreigner to me, just reading the...
There are features that make it seem as though he's a foreigner, but he is a worshiper of the Lord. One of the features in Deuteronomy 18, but of course Deuteronomy 18 is after this, was the prophets were supposed to be from Israel. I'm not entirely sure. It's been a question mark that I've had, and I haven't really pursued it. Because the Deuteronomy 18 passage is subsequent to this. But he was a disobedient worshiper of the Lord. Any other questions on Numbers?
Yes. At the second census, all the tribes are considerably smaller. And is that from God's wrath? Or is that from war?
Well, there were wars that did happen during their time in the wilderness. In fact, when we were looking last week at at Jephthah, he made allusion to wars against Ammon and against Moab. But there also were the times that large portions of the population died in rebellion against God. And so I wouldn't say that we have a complete history of what happened. It is a selective history, and so reductions, there could be alternate explanations.
Yeah, because I would have, in my head, I thought they were getting bigger and bigger, and that's not what happened at all.
Right.
My second question is, when they're bringing 16 lambs and 14 chickens and all the oxen and all of those things. Is each one of those part of the Torah rules that had to be followed, the 600 and whatever?
Yeah, it is part of those, yes.
Okay. So they had a lot to remember.
Oh, yes. Yes.
That's
yeah, they didn't even have PCs.
No, I can't imagine.
Any other questions about numbers? Okay, everybody understood. Okay, why don't we then...
Oh, wait, I have one more question.
Okay, very good.
Because I have bad notes. What was the difference between tithing and redemption money?
Okay, actually that's leading into something that I was wanting to preface what we're before we get into the study itself. But there were three separate tithes that the Old Testament stipulated. We had two that were conducted each year, and then there was a third one that took place every third year. So if you average it out, if a person had, say, let's say, the same income per year, it averages out to 23 1/3%. So when people talk about tithing, New Testament is not under a tithe. Tithe is a specific amount required for a specific feature. Now, when we consider differences between the Old Testament and the New Testament, and we kind of got into a discussion about this last week, that in some ways the Old Testament seems drastically different than the New Testament. Here we have all these rules that say under what circumstances people are to be put to death, and we've got all the various requirements, and if the nation got into certain types of rebellion, it could be evicted from the land even though it has the title deed to it, and so on. Those features we see because Israel was a nation. Church is not a nation. The entire New Testament takes place within the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire is who had the power of the sword. It was who had the military, who had the police forces, who had to maintain civil order, and so on and so forth. Church is never seen, never depicted as a national entity. That immediately removes all of the civil types of functions. Some of the tithes are equivalent to taxation to support the civil government. There were also tithes to support, there was a tithe to support the Levitical priesthood and the sanctuary. And then there was a separate tithe that was designed to provide for those that were impoverished. So those were completely distinct things. And so when people talk about a tithe, and they think 10%, and then they think, oh, the Old Testament said tithe, where do we find in the New Testament a requirement to tithe?
Where does the 10% come from?
Well, it was 10%. Tithe is 10%, okay. But it was a 10% for the civil government. There was another 10% to support the priesthood and the sanctuary, and every third year there was a separate 10% that was extracted in order to support those that were impoverished. So they were tithes, but there were three of them. New Testament never, not a single time, requires a tithe. Never. Now let's see what the New Testament does speak up. And for that, we'll go to 2 Corinthians. Let me give a little bit of explanation before I go into this section. This is not describing the normal weekly donations or the donations in order to support those that were ministering to a particular congregation and so forth. But there was a famine that made it so that food prices in Jerusalem rose dramatically, and believers in Jerusalem were going without. And so Paul had asked all the churches that he was involved in to set aside monies for that purpose in order to help the saints in Jerusalem. The Corinthians volunteered early. And they said, we're on board. And then afterwards, and so Paul told some of the churches in northern Greece, in Macedonia, about the Corinthians and how generous they were planning to be. And then the Corinthians, after he had told about all this, started backing out. And so let's start at 8:1 in 2 Corinthians. Moreover, brethren, we make known to you the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia. The part of Greece where Corinth is, and by the way, we're planning to go to Corinth next year, as well as to go to Macedonia. The part of Corinth in the south, part of Greece where Corinth is known as Achaia. But Macedonia is northern Greece. He said that in the great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty. Philippi and Thessalonica and some of the other churches are the ones up in Macedonia, and we find elsewhere that they were going through a lot of persecution. He says, in their deep poverty, they abounded in the riches of their liberality. They were contributing towards this fund to help believers in Jerusalem in ways that Paul said was beyond what he would have expected. So he says in verse 3, for I bear witness that according to their ability, yes, and beyond their ability, they were freely willing, imploring us with much urgency that we would receive the gift and the, your translation probably says fellowship, but participation of administering to the saints. That is, they were wanting to participate financially. And not only as we had hoped, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and then to us by the will of God. So we urged Titus that as he had begun, so he would also complete this grace in you as well. So he's saying, we urged Titus, who is one of our assistants, to encourage you also to give. Now it turns out that they backed away from that, and so Paul says in 9:1, now concerning the ministering to the saints, it is superfluous for me to write to you. I really shouldn't have to write this. For I know your willingness, they had spoken about it a year earlier, about which I boast of you to the Macedonians, that Achaia, South Greece, was ready a year ago, and your zeal has stirred up the majority. So he said, when I told people about what you were doing, they joined in, they said, wow, we really want to contribute. And so now he says, yet I have sent the brethren, lest our boasting of you should be in vain in this respect, that as I said, you may be ready, lest if some Macedonians come with me and find you unprepared, we, not to mention you, should be ashamed of this confident boasting. Therefore, I thought it necessary to exhort the brethren to go to you ahead of time and prepare your generous gift beforehand. So he's saying, you talked big, and I told other people what you were planning to do. You're going to be embarrassed when I come through, and all of a sudden everyone finds out how stingy you were. Now he goes on to clarify the overall thought. Verse 6. But this I say, he who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and he who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. So he said, there's great reward for the one who is generous. But let each one give as he purposes in his heart, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loves a cheerful giver. And he explains elsewhere in this context that people are to give according to how God has prospered. Now, what that means is, if God has really prospered us, percentage will be higher than if we are just barely making ends meet. He's not speaking about a given percentage that's required of anyone. But what he wants us to be able to do is, when we give, that we give it cheerfully, saying, this money the Lord has allowed me to have, and I want it to go for his purposes. But he's saying, if you're giving and saying, I really feel bad about giving this much, oh, I wish I could hang on to it. He's saying that's the wrong attitude. And we ought to give in a way that we're able to say, I am happy to give what I'm giving to the Lord. There is no percentage that is required anywhere in the New Testament. But you do notice that he says those who give generously will be rewarded generously. Jesus, I think, has made it very clear when we look at the Sermon on the Mount, we can't take our treasure with us. Right?
Right.
But we can send it on ahead. The concept is, if a person is generous and they give to the Lord, the rewards precede them to heaven. We can't take our riches with us, but they can be sent on ahead. Let me illustrate that by going to 3 John. 3 John is almost the end of your Bible. Revelation will be after it, and Jude will be after it. In the passage we're going to look at, John is looking at these congregations to whom he writes, and there would be traveling preachers who would come through, and the question is, how are they going to deal with them? He says in verse 5, Beloved, you do faithfully whatever you do for the brethren, people you know that are believers, and for strangers, believers that you don't know, who have borne witness of your love before the church. If you send them forward on their journey in a manner worthy of God, you will do well. So he's saying, if they come through and you make it a little easier for them to continue their journey, that would be doing well. Because they went forth for his name's sake, taking nothing from the Gentiles. In this particular area of Asia Minor, at this time, most of the believers were Jewish. So he's saying they weren't trying to raise money from unbelievers. They weren't going out to Gentiles who were largely unevangelized, but they were depending upon Jews who believed in Jesus Christ for their financial support. But it's really fun to look at verse 8. Therefore, we ought to receive such that we may become fellow workers for the truth.
John, I'm sorry, where are you?
Third John.
Third John, I'm sorry. Thank you.
And so in verse 8, he's saying that you can become a partner with people that you support financially in ministry. Now, what does a partnership involve? If there's a profit, what happens for the partner? There's a sharing of profit, right? And the type of profit that he's talking about is rewards.
Yeah.
It is possible to share in the rewards of other people. That's part of the picture of how Jesus talks about you can't take it with you, but you can send it on ahead. It is possible to share in the rewards of others by facilitating them in their ministry. But again, the New Testament does not set an amount, and when the Old Testament speaks of tithes, there are three separate tithes. They were required. They were taxed. Just like we are required to pay taxes, whether it's sales tax, use tax, excise tax, income tax, you name it, we are required. Have you ever seen a tax that they said, if you want to pay it, you can pay it, but if you don't want to pay it, you don't have to?
Sorry.
And so, Old Testament, giving of the type that is a tithe is a requirement by law. Free will offerings were voluntary. And they have the opportunity for rewardability on that basis. But there is an absolutely huge difference between Old Testament and New Testament because the church has no governmental function. Church doesn't raise an army, doesn't have police forces, doesn't build highways, doesn't do all those kinds of things. And so church is voluntarily supported. No tax and no ability to penalize people for not contributing. But rewardability is connected with how we respond within a context where things are voluntary rather than being governmental and required. So when you look at the Old Testament and you see requirements, you have to realize you're looking partly at government. And that's a major difference between the Old Testament and New Testament that hardly anyone thinks about. But it changes a lot of things. And that's why you see capital punishment being exercised. That's why you see a lot of things happening directly through the instrumentality of those that were put in authority. Now, God has always and always will exercise sovereignty over the universe, which involves consequences and so on and so forth. That hasn't ended. Just because the church is not government doesn't mean that God has changed in the way he deals with humanity as a whole. But it does mean that the agency, the church, through which God works, has exactly a comparable role to government. That's a major difference between Old Testament and New Testament.
So, John, after Israel instituted a king, Saul, were governmental taxes implemented as well?
Oh, yes, but there were taxes prior to that as well.
Okay.
But you didn't have a centralized government, really, after they entered the land up until the time that you had a king. When you look at judges, you're basically looking at best a tribal level, and they would have confederations sometimes of tribes to accomplish something bigger.
Okay, thank you.
Have there been examples of governments supporting a state-sponsored church? Did the Church of England get supported by a government?
Oh, yes.
Did they?
There are a lot of churches that are... I mean, the Holy Roman Empire, back in like the time of Charlemagne, you know, 800 and so on and so forth, you had a hybrid government mixed with church, completely contrary to what the New Testament was articulating. And you know, they would talk about how we need to make sure that everyone in our country is baptized into our state religion, because that's a way of saying that they're a citizen of the country and more. And that was completely contrary to what the New Testament was ever aiming at.
Is that the same with the Russian Greek?
The Russian Orthodox, and yeah. And in Finland, the Finnish Lutheran Church, and all
of Scandinavia. Are they still going on to this day?
It's been separated from the state as a result of the Russian Bolshevik Revolution.
Okay. And currently, Islam is a theocracy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. That it is. So I thought that that might clarify a few things that we talked about a little bit last week. That yes, we do see differences between the Old Testament and New Testament, but it is not a diametric change in the character of God. It is the fact that God has chosen to work through a different type of an agency, one that is not governmentally associated. And that is a major reason for changes between Old and New Testament. It is not saying that God has fundamentally changed. Now, we have another major difference, and that is that rather than the yet future payment for sin in its entirety for the whole human race, which Israel was always looking forward to that, and their worship system was in anticipation of Jesus doing that. New Testament, once we get up to the cross, is always looking at that as a past event. However, the New Testament presents other things that are yet to be fulfilled. The rapture of the church is yet future. The tribulation is yet future. The second coming is yet future. The millennial kingdom is yet future. So there are things that we still anticipate, things that the New Testament is pointing us towards. But we are able to look at the solution, the payment for sin that was accomplished by Jesus Christ as something accomplished, whereas the worship system of Israel was looking in anticipation of that happening. But once again, we are not looking at a fundamental change in God. We are looking at there have been historic events that have made it so that certain things that they looked forward to, we can look back at. Okay, let's go to Judges.
John, can we
yes.
do one more quick question?
Sure.
This the tax on the poor that's every third year, was that a direct payment from a middle class or wealthy family to the poor, or would that... Was there a government?
Yeah, there was.
It was a tax.
Yeah, it was a tax that was. In each case, there was a specific place to handle the payment, and then it would go for. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
John, I just have one. Tell me if this is would take too long. Then. The when Miriam and Aaron challenge Moses and then she gets leprosy, and this idea of Deuteronomy 18 and Jesus being the mouthpiece of God and him coming down pretty harshly on her for challenging his mouthpiece, you see a correlation between those two?
I do, yeah.
maybe something we should take away from this?
Yeah, the what Isaiah says in Isaiah 55, God's word does not go forth from him without accomplishing what he has sent it to do. His word is never an optional, and those through whom it comes are not to be dismissed. Look at what John 5 says, that the right of judgment at the great white throne was given to Jesus as the Son of Man, so that all would honor the Son as they should honor the Father. The mouthpiece of God is to be heeded because it is the word of God that is being communicated. Let's see, I'll digress a little bit on that. As I was preparing for the lecture that I had today at school, I was working very closely in John chapters 4 and 5. And Jesus makes a statement in John 4, I believe verse 44, where he says that a prophet is not without honor except in his own homeland. And so that was given as a reason for Jesus leaving Judea down south and going up to Galilee. And there was something that I noticed there that I had not noticed before. We were told that he had to pass through Samaria. Now, Samaria would not be considered his homeland. But what happened when he was in Samaria? When he told the Samaritan woman about her five husbands and the fact that she was living with someone that she was not married to, her response was, "I perceive that you are a prophet." Out of his homeland, he was recognized as prophet. He came into his own, and by and large, he was not perceived as a prophet, let alone as the prophet. Now, in John 6:14, as a result of him feeding the 5,000, we have a group of people that proclaim, "This is the prophet who is to come." But I started thinking about Jesus' dealings with the royal official in John 4. The royal official heard that Jesus had come up into Galilee. Jesus had previously made his headquarters in Capernaum. The royal official was from Capernaum. He heard that Jesus came, but Jesus came to Cana, a full day's walk away. He went over to Cana in order to tell him, "Come down, heal my son before he dies." His son had a high fever, was in danger of dying at any time. Jesus made a statement that people have misunderstood. It uses y'all. It uses plural form. He's speaking to the Father, and he says, "Unless y'all," he's talking more broadly than the men, talking about the nation, "unless you, the nation, see signs and wonders, y'all by no means will believe." Jesus was not rebuking the men. But based upon Deuteronomy 18, that was the expectation. There would be signs given by the prophet proving that he was who he said he was. What does this man do? He approaches Jesus and he says, "You can heal my son." This man is unusual. He, I believe, has perceived that Jesus is at least a prophet, if not the prophet. And so he says, "You can heal it." Jesus makes an overall statement, perhaps not even speaking to the Father, perhaps speaking to those who were present, saying that it is signs and wonders in keeping with Deuteronomy 18 that would be the only thing that would lead to belief because of the expectation of Deuteronomy 18. How many other times do we see in John's Gospel someone requesting a sign from Jesus?
What's the question?
How many other times do we see someone requesting a sign from Jesus that he did?
Well, in chapter 6 we have it.
Okay, sure. But they're requesting it as...
After he's done.
John 2.
2, at the temple, when he cleanses the temple.
Well, before that, Mary approaches him and says they have no wine. Mm. And from his answer, we can tell that she was seeking for him to take care of it. Where else?
Show us a sign. In 14?
I would say chapter 11.
With the healing of Lazarus?
Because the sisters sent word saying, "The one whom you love is sick." Mm. They weren't requesting for him to raise him because they weren't expecting that he was going to let him die. But they were requesting for him to heal it. Now, I would say those are three examples of recognition of Jesus as Messiah. When we look at chapter 6 and they're asking for a sign, Jesus...
That's a rejection.
Yeah, he tells them that they aren't seeking him. You know, they just want to be, they want food. They don't want him. So I think it's significant. Now, I think that the passage there in John 4 of a prophet is not without honor except in his own homeland is a door opener on some things.
We had in chapter 6 today when I was teaching, you know, the problem of verse 14 and 15 with the nearest antecedent, because they were kind of confused about those two. But I think I said, who do they recognize him as in 14? The prophet. What are you going to do when you see the prophet? Like the woman at the well said, what are you telling me? Because this is your God's word, so what are you telling us to do? The kingmakers want to make him. They don't want to listen to him. They want to tell him.
Right.
So it has to be two different people.
Right. And verse 26, I think, reinforces.
Which is?
You don't seek me because you saw the signs.
Oh, yeah.
But because you ate and were satisfied.
Right.
Okay, let's go to Judges. We looked last time at Jephthah, so we need to, since we're going to look at Jephthah part two, we need to do a little bit of review. Overall, Israel has seven major enemies within the land that God promised to displace, and I have a mnemonic to help remember them, and it's Gakfaj. So Gakfaj is the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. Changing the G and H just to make it fit together a little better. Deuteronomy 7:1. When the Lord your God brings you into the land which you go to possess and has cast out many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, with this map showing their approximate locations. Seven nations greater and mightier than you. They had a response that they were to conduct. The book of Judges is arranged around a series of sin cycles. In each case, Israel becomes involved in idolatry. As a result, a foreign power takes away land that they had conquered under Joshua. They are under servitude. They are being taxed. They are having all sorts of bad things that are happening to them because they are in violation of the land covenant. So they pray. They supplicate. And God is faithful to deliver them when they pray. It isn't because they cleaned up their act and so on and so forth. It's because he had pledged to do so. But when they cry out, he gives them deliverance. But the deliverance that they receive is not bringing them forward to taking more of the land. It's at best a retaking of land that has been taken from them subsequent to Joshua. For all intents and purposes, it's like they are always playing defense and they never carry the ball. They never move forward. They're always failing, even at their very best. Well, then after that, they have a period of silence. There's a period where they have rest from their enemies. This set of cycles repeats itself all the way through the book of Judges. We're considering one of the judges by the name of Jephthah. And they have had problems because of the Amorites who have come in and created havoc for them. And the Lord has raised up Jephthah in order to give deliverance. But the Bible does not sugarcoat the character of the people that are even portrayed as, shall we say, heroes. Jephthah was a deliverer. He was given to them by the Lord, but he definitely had his problems. We considered last time the battles that he waged and that allowed the retaking of the land, so I'll show a couple of slides related to it. We're looking across the Jordan River. That would be on the other side of these trees. This side is Israel. You cross the river, it's Jordan. And these, the high elevations that you see behind there is the land of Gilead. It is an upland area and so forth. When the military campaigns were conducted, they were against Ammon. And when you hear about the city of Ammon, Jordan, that is named after the Ammonites, and it's the general area where they occupied. Well, Jephthah led forces up the Jabbok River. When you look at the terrain in this area, you have to travel through river valleys. If you're trying to go over the mountains, you're not going to be able to bring a military force over them. So everyone would travel by means of the rivers. So you see here, we have the Jordan River going from north to south into the Dead Sea on the left-hand side of that. And he crosses over into the river valley and goes up the Jabbok River and then conquers a series of places. We're told that there were about 20 cities that he took. Then he's going to return back to Mizpah, and we're going to have events here that are going to happen in the area of Mizpah and in the area of Zaphon. I could not find any pictures of Zaphon itself. And that's why I'm a little shy on pictures this time. Not quite as many as we've had the past couple. This is typical terrain in Gilead. It's an upland region, If anyone's going to travel, they're traveling through the river valleys. But issues are going to arise with here of several types, and they actually seem largely to be of Jephthah's own doing. As we break in at chapter 11, verse 29 for background, the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, and he passed through Gilead and Manasseh. Manasseh is one of the tribes of Israel, and they're on the east side of Jordan. Let me go forward two slides. Oops. Sorry. If you notice, on the east side of the Jordan River up north, you see Manasseh. You also see Manasseh on the west side. The tribe of Manasseh occupied two areas. So Manasseh is going to be involved, and also the area of Gad, both of them being focused upon east of the Jordan River. Now, do you see that sort of a turquoise area that's called Ephraim? Ephraim is also going to be involved here within this passage that we're going to look at. So that gives an idea of general locales. Oops, wrong direction. So we have in verse 29, chapter 11, the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, and he passed through Gilead and Manasseh, passed through Mizpah of Gilead. And you can see this is, there are other places in the Bible called Mizpah, but this is Mizpah in Gilead. And so he's passing back through there on his way back to the Jordan River. And so he advanced toward the people of Ammon, and Jephthah made a vow to the Lord, and so on and so forth. This is going to be the part of the passage we're going to focus upon, is the vow. But drop down now to verse 32. In verses 32 and 33 that we considered last week, this is where he won all of these military battles in the area that is shown in the gray on the map. But before the battle began, in verse 30, he made a vow to the Lord, and he said to the Lord, "If you will indeed deliver the people of Ammon into my hands, then it will be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me, when I return in peace from the people of Ammon, shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up as a burnt offering." So what do you think was the first thing to greet him? Drop down to verse 34.
Daughter.
When Jephthah came to his house at Mizpah, there was his daughter coming out to meet him with timbrels and dancing. She was his only child. Okay. Now, what's he expecting to come out of his house?
Dog.
It could be an animal, or it could be a daughter.
Or a servant.
Could be a servant. So, now we have, in order for us to consider the vow that he makes, we have to consider the most controversial part of his vow. And I am going to say here that the take that I have is my best take on it, but the grammar is a bit open. There are two possibilities. First one, for translation options in 1131. What comes will be the Lord, and I will offer it as a burnt offering. So there are many people that take this passage as he's saying, whatever comes, it's going to be burnt on an altar, and that's it. There's a second option, which is the one that I take. What or who comes, he or she, or in the latter part of the sentence, it would be it. he or she will be the Lord's. Or, second option, I will offer it as a burnt offering. So if his dog came, burnt offering. If a person came, dedicated to the Lord. Okay, you're going to serve in the tabernacle for the rest of your life. Now, grammatically, it is easier to take the first option. And the reason it's easier is because the word the, that is, it's normally translated and or but, would be translated and. So in that first translation option, I have rendered it as and. The second option, though, somewhat rarer, actually quite a bit rarer, but it does happen, is that the word the should be understood as or. I'd like to illustrate a few passages. We won't be anywhere near extensive, but look back at Exodus chapter 20. It's far more common for it to mean and or but. But it is a word that can mean or. Exodus chapter 20, verse 10. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. By the way, that's another difference. Digressing. New Testament does not require anyone to keep the seventh day. And the Old Testament didn't require it until the time of Moses. Right here. There's a lot of Bible in front of Exodus 20. It came into place here. We talked about that. We've looked at John 7. We've seen that it came in subsequently. Came in time of Moses. Did not come in at the time of patriarchs. Definitely did not come in at the time of the creation. So here, this is a new rule. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord. In it you shall do no work. You. Now, would it be logical to translate this? You and your son and your daughter and your male servant and your female servant and your cattle and your stranger who is in your gates. How many people would have all of those for whom it would be and? So you notice it's translated or, but it's the same word, the. Certain circumstances, the can mean or. Look a little later in the passage. Verse 17. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife and his male servant and his female servant and his ox and his donkey or anything that is your neighbor's. It doesn't make sense as and. I give you another passage in chapter 21, verse 16 as another example. And these are not by any matter of means the only examples. Look at 21:16. He who kidnaps a man and sells him, and is, if he is found in his hand, well, if he sells him, how is he still in his hand?
Right.
It has to be or. Shall be put to death. So there are two ways that this vow is approached. One is to say, no matter who or what comes, it belongs to the Lord from now on, and I'm going to give it as a burnt offering. Second option, which many hold, and I do, is that he's saying, if my dog comes, burnt offering. But if a person comes, going to the tabernacle, going to serve for the rest of the life. Sort of like what happened with Anna in the New Testament, and what happened with Samuel in the book of 1 Samuel. And so, there's going to be a problem that we're going to have to deal with, and I will have to be able to resolve it. And it's one of the main reasons that people, not everyone holds to the view that I'm going to articulate, but I think I've got a good solution. So, he has made this vow. And in verse 34 and 35, he finds to his horror that his only daughter was the first to greet him. I don't know who he was wishing was going to come out first, but there might have been someone he was hoping would come out the door. It's obviously not going to be one of his children, because this is his only child. Now, I have to ask a question. Do we see anywhere here that the Lord told him to make this vow? No, we don't. Book of Judges, every man did what was right in his own eyes. Jephthah did give enough indication within chapter 11 that I don't think it's likely that he thought that giving a person as a burnt offering would be pleasing to the Lord. So I don't think he was that biblically illiterate to have thought that, because he gave quite a history of Israel back in chapter 11. Well, when Jephthah came to his house at Mizpah, there was his daughter coming out to meet him with timbrels and dancing, and she was his only child. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter. And it came to pass when he saw her that he tore his clothes and said, "Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low. You are among those who trouble me." He sounds like a blame shifter. "For I have given my word to the Lord, and I cannot go back on it." Now, if we were to read Leviticus chapter 27, there were various ways that a person could get out of a rash vow. But he says, "I can't go back on it," so he's bound and determined that he's going to follow through. But besides that, verse 36, his daughter speaks, and she says that she's willing to suffer the consequences of the vow. So she said to him, "My father, if you have given your word to the Lord, do to me according to what has gone out of your mouth, because the Lord has avenged you of all your enemies, the people of Ammon." So she says, "I'm not going to ask you to go back on your word to the Lord."
But your way sounds so much, that makes much more sense to me, because the other way just sounds dopey. I'm going to burn my daughter.
So she makes a request. She says, "Okay, you're going to have to go through with this, but you didn't promise to do it today, did you? We can have a little bit of a delay, right?" And so she requests in verse 37, she said to her father, "Let this thing be done for me. Let me alone for 2 months, that I may go and wander on the mountains and bewail my virginity, my friends and I." So she's going to do some camping out for a couple months with some of her girlfriends. And they're going to be up in the mountains, because that's where they are. They're in Gilead. And they're going off by themselves, and they're going to mourn. They're going to be talking about how rough her circumstances are, and they're going to be comforting one another. Kind of sounds like Job with his three friends. And in verse 38, it actually describes the exile that she has. "First, he said, 'Go.' And he sent her away for 2 months, and she went with her friends and bewailed her virginity on the mountains." And it was, she was there. She did what she had asked for. And in verse 39, then the vow is carried out. "And it was so at the end of 2 months that she returned to her father, and he carried out his vow with which he had vowed. She knew no man." So she died, ultimately, I would say probably many years later, as a virgin. Now, the question that's raised here is similar to something that my son George, that many of you know, he's been reading through the Book of Judges repeatedly for quite a period of time since we started in Judges. And one of the things that he does when he's driving into school is he has on his sound system in the car, he has a reading of the Book of Judges as he goes into work, and a reading of the Book of Judges as he comes back, that is, from school and work. And he's been doing some reading, and he ran into an interesting anecdote. There was a seminary student, and they were studying this passage. And this particular seminary student was not a young man, had never been married, didn't have very good social skills, and he was challenging the professor's view. The professor argued that the daughter of Jephthah was being dedicated to the Lord. And so he said, how could living out her life as a single person be that terrible a thing? And this guy had no plans of getting married, and so on and so forth. And the professor said, "You have just revealed how little you know about women. Especially in that day and age, she would have expected to live out her life being married and having children. And in that society, for a woman to be childless was a great dishonor. She was looking, and she said, 'My father made a vow, and that vow changes my life forever. I will not be married. I will not have children.' That would have hit her really hard. We look at it, and some people look at it and say, well, death would be the only thing that would shake her to the core like this. But the vow that Jephthah made is one that turned her world upside down. The upshot of it was, verse 40, it became a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel went out 4 days each year to lament the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite." This is a man who at times accomplished things that the Lord wanted. But the Bible has, as heroes, people with feet of clay. And the Bible doesn't sugarcoat it. Jephthah is going to create another difficulty. I think it's largely his own doing here. This is going to be with the tribe of Ephraim, and you can see it there as the turquoise colored area in the center of the map of Israel on the right. And the picture here that's on the, or the map that's on the left, is focusing upon the area of Ephraim. It also is a hilly region. Looking a little closer, we see a map on the left that shows you the Sea of Galilee up north, Abel Meholah, and then you see that star. That star would be the approximate location of Siphon. You keep going south and you end up at the Dead Sea. You'll notice a little bit south, and then going eastward from that star on that map, the Jabbok River. And so as you look on the right-hand side, you see Abel Mehola, you see Sukkot, you see Peniel. Peniel and Sukkot being very close to the Jabbok River. And then you see Tsafon. So Tsafon is going to be the place where there's going to be a meeting with people from the tribe of Ephraim. Let's look at this from an aerial view. This is, I've shown with the yellow line, that's the Jordan River, and it's flowing towards the right, towards the south. And then across you see Gilead, and you see the elevated regions, and the Jabbok River is following the course that is the white that is traced in purple. And so the location of Tsafon would be a little bit off towards the left on this map. It's not, or this overhead picture, so it's not depicted, but you can see there that we've got a flat valley for the Jordan River, but immediately behind it would be a mountainous region. Let's look at it from a different perspective. This is a map that I've shown, or a depiction I've shown for other purposes, but this would be looking as an aerial view over the Dead Sea and looking on towards the Sea of Galilee, and you can see the Mediterranean Sea. And the area of Tsafon would be where the star is along the Jordan River, and just below it you can see the Jabbok River and the canyon through which it would go. Now, to bring this into a map perspective, we'll return to the map of Jephthah's campaigns. He first had the battles in the area of the gray, the successes of chapter 11. He returned to his home in Mizpah, and now we're going to have a meeting that's going to happen in Tsafon, which is by the Jordan River, and he is going to be met by people who come up another river valley and then come along the Jordan River from the tribe of Ephraim, which I've shown you that hilly region. So in chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, we have charges and countercharges. Now remember, we have had the great battle that took place in chapter 11 against the Ammonites. And so in chapter 12, then the men of Ephraim gathered together, crossed over towards Tsafon, and said to Jephthah, "Why did you cross over to fight against the people of Ammon, and why did you not call us to go with you? We will burn your house down on you with fire." They said, "You should have invited us, and since we didn't participate, we didn't get to take any of the spoils of battle, we are going to burn your house down, we're going to penalize you." Well, Jephthah says to them, "My people and I were in a great struggle with people of Ammon, and when I called out, you did not deliver me out of their hands." So he says, "I asked for your help, and you didn't come to help. So when I saw that you would not deliver me, I took my life in my hands and crossed over against the people of Ammon, and the Lord delivered them into my hand. Why then have you come up to me this day to fight against me?" Now, does it sound like the tribes are functioning as a nation?
No,
they're going to war against each other, and later in this book we're going to see them just about decimate the tribe of Benjamin. Kurt, when you asked about national taxes before Saul, they were constantly in struggle with each other because they were in rebellion against the Lord. So what happens as a result of that? We have a battle against the tribe of Ephraim. Now Jephthah gathered together all the men of Gilead and fought against Ephraim. And the men of Gilead defeated Ephraim because they said, you Gileadites are fugitives of Ephraim among the Ephraimites and among the Manassites. So now we're going to have something you probably have heard of, and that's the Shibboleth, or the Sibboleth. In verses 5 and 6, the Gileadites seized the fords of the Jordan before the Ephraimites arrived. And when any Ephraimite who escaped said, let me cross over, the men of Gilead would say to him, are you an Ephraimite? If he said no, then they would say to him, then say Shibboleth. And he would say Sibboleth, for they could not pronounce it right. Then they would take him and kill him at the fords of the Jordan. That's going to be a place that's easy to cross the Jordan River. There fell at that time 42,000 Ephraimites. And so, what is a Shibboleth? There are two possibilities. One is it refers to a flowing stream like this, and this is the Jabbok, by the way. Now, when the text was originally written, there were no points. Points tell us vowels, and points differentiate the letter seen from the letter sheen. And you may... let's digress.
John, you're saying points show with
The little dots. Okay. Now, these dots are distinguishing two ways of pronouncing one letter. Now, I can show you that in Hebrew they regard it as one letter. Let's look at Psalm 119. This is just an aside here to what we have here is what's called an acrostic psalm. And what that means is that each line of this psalm would start with a different letter of the alphabet. So, verses 1 through 8, most of your Bibles probably have the Hebrew letter Aleph there, and then they say Aleph. Mm-hmm. Now go down to verse 9. You have Beit. And by the way, I use modern Hebrew pronunciation so the THs are not pronounced as THs. Then you have Gimel at verse 17, the Dalet, verse 25, and so forth. So let's go to the end of that psalm, and the last letter is Tav. But before the Tav, we have, it says Sheen. And before that, you have Resh. But we only have one of the seen sheen letters. So in Hebrew, it was originally regarded as one letter that could be pronounced two different ways. So when it was first written, it was written like this with no point. Then later on, they said, well, there are certain words that we pronounce s, and there are certain words we pronounce sh. So when we're writing, why don't we put a dot to tell which one it is? And so this is the letter seen, and this is the letter sheen. Now, there's a little trick, if any of you want to learn Hebrew besides Steve, that makes it easy to keep seen and sheen apart. And that's a little mnemonic. Sin is never right. The sin, the sin, has the dot on the left. Sin is never right. No. Shin is right. So one possibility is that Shibboleth, which the people from Ephraim would say Sibboleth, would mean a brook or a stream. And another possibility is that it's a head of grain. But in any event, the people from Ephraim had an accent. And they wouldn't say it the right way. And so they You may have heard the story about during Prohibition, across the Canadian border, the ATF would ask people to say the alphabet. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, Z. If the person said Z, they would say, "You're Canadian." And so the only letter that they were really concerned about was how they said the last letter of the alphabet. And that's a shibboleth. A shibboleth is something that is a speech pattern that can be used to say, you're a foreigner. And so they were trying to figure out, because they didn't wear uniforms, and you couldn't tell the difference between them because they were all Jewish, but just the way that they would say this word would tell them whether they were from the tribe of Ephraim or they were from Gilead. And anyone who said it the wrong way, it was probably about the last word they said. And so now we're going to hear that Jephthah was judged for 40 years. And we've had some judges that lasted that long. Not Jephthah. Jephthah ruled or judged Israel 6 years. Then Jephthah the Gileadite died and was buried among the cities of Gilead. What a hero. What a hero. God raised up a deliverer in answer to Israel's prayer. But how much better it would have been if Israel had said, "Lord, we need you as our king." But Israel was still in rebellion. God only raises up leaders for a nation that the nation deserves.
Yes, John. Chapter 11 specifies that Jephthah is a Gileadite, which is, I understand that to be a region.
Yes.
It does not specify his tribe.
I would expect...
It appears to be in the tribal area of Gad.
Yeah. His where he went when he ran away, he ran north. Let's look back at that.
Perhaps east of Manasseh?
Yeah, it is a possibility. Let's see.
Anyway, I don't necessarily want to get you down a rabbit trail or rabbit hole there. My second question is...
The land of Tov mentioned in 11:3, when he ran away, because the fact that his mother was a harlot and he wasn't welcomed by his family, his brother's family, he got kicked out. When he was kicked out, he went north. So Gad or Manasseh would be the logical guesses.
Okay. My second one goes back to his vow, and again, the distinction with voluntary offering. Is a voluntary offering, could a father make a conditional voluntary offering aside from an authority that dictates a vow that would be binding on the person, the daughter, for example? Or is it the daughter's liberty to make her own voluntary offering? In other words, can your father make you into a voluntary offering? How's that voluntary? Does that make sense at all?
Sure, it does.
Where's that section where the husband over the wife, and if the wife does a vow and...
Yeah, when
it's silly or crazy.
Right, when one looks at laws of vows, there are a lot of restrictions on them, and there are circumstances when they can be backed out of, and there are certain people who had to take responsibility for the vows that they made. If a daughter who was in a father's house made a vow, the vow could be canceled by the father, or if a wife made a vow living in the house of her husband, if he found out about it, he could cancel that vow. Which is saying that the husband or father ultimately bore the responsibility of a vow made by either a daughter or by a wife. It does seem that Hannah's vow early in 1 Samuel was regarded as binding upon Samuel. She said, she was barren, she didn't have any children. She said, "Lord, if you give me a son, I will dedicate him." And he was dedicated the rest of his life. There were vows in regard to Samson. We'll run into that later in the book of Judges, and we'll see that he was even more clay-footed than Jephthah. But it's uncommon to have a vow that involves someone else, but there are some that show up during the time of Judges, because Jephthah's in the time of Judges, Samson's in the time of Judges, and Samuel is in the time of Judges, even though not recorded in the book of Judges. But offhand, I can't think of vows that were exercised that way afterwards. And I don't see that we have scripture saying that this was something that was pleasing to God. It may have been something adopted from some of the foreign cultures.
It's interesting they were so adamant about that and not about some of the other things that they told them.
Great point. Great point.
Yeah, I think it's interesting when I think of vows, I always think of wedding vows, which is an ordinance declared by the institution of marriage. And thus would become a vow. In other words, there's a higher authority, the institution of marriage. So when a man and a woman are joined,
something like a vow.
Anyway, never mind.
Yeah, I mean, it's. Offhand, I cannot think of endorsement. Of it, but it seemed to be a practice that was going on during the time of the judges.
Okay. It just that.
Yeah.
It seems like on the Sermon on the Mount when Jesus says, "Let your yes be yes and your no be no."
Right.
Trying to say, you guys can't keep a vow. You're a liar. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, what does Romans say? God is true, and every man's a liar.
Both Jesus and James speak against volunteering for a vow.
Yeah.
Now, many people interpret it as though both Jesus and James prohibited accepting a vow. But if that were the case, in Matthew 26, Jesus accepted a vow. The way that that happened was that the high priest said, "I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ," and Jesus gave an answer. He was being put under an oath formula by the high priest. You will also hear preachers often condemn Paul for having made a vow in the book of Acts. However, the vows and the cleansings were essential parts of being able to partake in some of the Jewish pilgrim feasts. And those were not prohibited, but it was known that in order to be able to participate, one had to make the offering, they had to make the vow, and they had to be ritually cleansed. So I don't see that there's any basis for saying that Paul was wrong for having accepted the vow, or going through the cleansing, or paying the temple tax. So my takeaway is, Jesus and James both prohibit volunteering for a vow. But if you are in a court situation and they say, we want you to take an oath, we are allowed to accept a vow, but we shouldn't volunteer for one. Our standard of truthfulness ought to be sufficient without having to make a vow in order to make it appear that it's true.